Thank you, Jason. Good to see everyone out on the Lord's Day. Certainly encouraging to see Sister Ella able to be with us. And I hope you've had a good night of rest. It is unusual, as Jason mentioned, that we would teach a whole lesson on some of these things. It is tragic that we need to. But this is a war. Satan is pushing hard on every front. And we have no choice but to fight back and fight for our salvation. And thank you for the good, patient way that you've studied with me through the whole past week. This morning, we have another subject that's not really pleasant to study, but we need to deal with it. The threat of pornography, making sex an idol. There's really nothing new. So we go back to Ephesians 5, 3 through 5. And read about people who became so obsessed with sexual desire that it became as an idol or a god. Ephesians 5, beginning verse 3. But fornication and all uncleanness, practices that lead to fornication, like pornography, or covetousness, unrestrained desire for a sexual experience. Let it not be once named among you as becometh saints, neither filthiness, nor foolish talking, nor jesting, filthy sexual talk, which are not convenient, means not right, not proper, but rather giving of thanks. For this you know, that no whoremonger, that's fornication again, nor unclean person, now look at this line, nor covetous man who is an idolater, hath any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God. We generally think of coveting in terms of seeking material gain. But in this context, the coveting, the unrestrained desire, has to do with sexual desire. And Paul said there were people making their sexual desire as their god or an idol. Of course, pornography depicts erotic and lewd sexual scenes in writing or pictures in a way that's not appropriate and contrary to God's plan and pattern that sexual needs are met in marriage. We need to study this threat of pornography because it is a threat to our morals. It's a threat to our marriages, and it's a threat to our nation. It corrodes the moral character of a nation of people. I want to study these points with you today. Number one, I want to start with God's purpose for sex. What it can do, what it cannot do. Number two, pornography and sex have been false gods all through history. So again, this is really not a new battle. It has just come before us again. In the second period, we'll talk about walking in love in a sex-saturated society, and then overcoming the sin and devastation of pornography. And then, lest Satan get advantage, we must learn to forgive the sinner. But first, let's think about God's purpose for sex, what it can and cannot do. Let's think about how many forms of life God created, and we are uniquely created in His image to have fellowship with Him. That is the key point of our existence. We were made to be friends of God. Genesis 1:27, God created man in His own image. In the image of God created He him. Male and female created He them. The physical aspect is the male and the female, but the spirit, the soul, is made in God's image. We're made in a likeness to God. Think about this, to be a companion to God. That's the purpose for our very existence. When He created us as sexual beings, male and female, this was in order to give the gift of marital love. Marital love means there must be a commitment And it means not like the animals, there is just a natural sex act, but sex is in the context of companionship, sharing our lives together. So in Genesis 2:24, think about this before I read the verse. There's a perfect harmony in the Godhead, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. They work in unison in every way. There's no conflict there. God created us male and female and then gave us this gift of marriage. And God designed it so that we as companions live in harmony and in unison with each other. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife. Now, and they shall be one flesh, perfect union and harmony. By the way, before you married, how many hands did you have to serve your needs? You had two. After you married, how many hands did you have to serve your needs? Oh, you had two more. We function as one, literally, serving each other in every possible way. The one flesh here is not referring exclusively to the sexual union. It's referring to the uniting of two lives as one. And the sexual union is just one aspect of that. Serving each other in this companionship. You know, we're reminded of that in the marriage vows we took. Can you remember the day you took those vows? I've been married 57 years. I remember that day clearly. The sexual intimacy of marriage echoes the vows we took that day. We made a lifelong commitment to each other, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness or in health, in adversity as in prosperity, and forsaking all others, to love and to cherish till death do us part. That initiates the deepest companionship we will share on this earth. And God put the sexual union in that framework. I want you to think of the sexual union not like the animal world. It's just a physical event. This is something deeper and richer. Now, what can sex accomplish? Well, it accomplishes this blending of two lives. That is, it's part of that. But of course, it also gives the gift of offspring in the context of a loving family. Animals have offspring, but not in the context like we have. Remember Psalm 127, verse 3. Well, children are an heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. Maybe you have some item or property that was handed down in the generations, and we treasure something like that. Our children are like that, a special gift, reward, or heritage. They express God's love, but they also express our love. They're the result of our shared love. And God designed this so that the children are conceived and raised in this context of unselfish, nourishing love. God did not design that children should be born by uncommitted, selfish lust. He did not intend that. And that becomes a curse. Not the child is not the curse, but bringing a child into the world in that circumstance is a curse. And God does not desire that. Something else we ought to think about as we reflect on this, God's purpose for sex, what it can do, it can reflect our reverential fear of God. So again, not purely a physical act. It has deeper, richer meanings. Here's why I say that. Hebrews 13, verse 4. Paul says marriage is honorable in all, and the bed, the marriage bed, that's a euphemism for the sexual union, undefiled, pure, clean, sacred. But whoremongers and adulterers, God will judge. Stepping outside the boundary of marriage will bring the wrath of God. But now think about this passage. When we honor marriage, we honor God. God made this to be an honorable union. And when we treat it that way, who do we honor? We honor the God who gave the gift of marriage. And that includes our fidelity in regard to the sexual union. And then I think back to Proverbs chapter 5, and verses 18 and 19. You know, Satan is just a master of sleight of hand and trickery and lies. And he has pretty successfully kidnapped sex as his domain. And it's not. That's a perversion. Sex is God's domain. It is God's gift. And that's why it is not something shameful, ugly, or the darker side of life. It's not any of that. It's a gift of God. God is the origin of our sensual love. Proverbs 5, 18 and 19, let thy fountain be blessed. God has given you a fountain. Rejoice with the wife of thy youth. Let her be as the loving hind in the pleasant roe. Admire her like you would a beautiful young deer. Let her breast satisfy thee at all times, and be thou ravished always with her love. Not one thing shameful in that verse. He compares our sexual union to a fresh, clean fountain of water that refreshes us and makes us healthy. This is God's domain. This is God's gift. Don't let Satan kidnap what God made. We're showing reverential fear for God when we accept this gift and keep it in the bonds of marriage. But now Proverbs 5, 22, 23 also talks about this deception that Satan practices. He offers enhancement. This is where he kidnaps the domain of sex, that fornication is some enhanced pleasure or joy or fulfillment, or adultery will enhance your sexual experience. No, look what Proverbs 5:22 said. The evil deeds of the wicked ensnare them. It's not enhanced pleasure and fulfillment. It's a trap. The cords of their sins hold them fast. For lack of discipline, they will die, led astray by their own folly. So Satan lies and deceives us. Fornication is an honor to Satan. It's an honor to Satan. And we need to honor God, not Satan. When we keep sex in the domain of marriage as God's gift, we are showing honor and reverence to the God who gave this gift. Our sexual life can accomplish many good purposes. There are things, though, that it cannot do. Sex cannot satisfy apart from God and His plan. Only God's design produces true fulfillment. Think a little bit more with me on this. God's design of the sexual nature shared in marriage means you have a proper function of our sexual nature, which actually promotes our physical health, our emotional well-being, even our psychological outlook. It's that fountain that feeds and nourishes and satisfies. And here's the key. Here's the key why it's like that in marriage. Because in marriage, you're not like the animal just performing a sex act. You're serving your mate. and your mate is serving you. It is done as a part of this united life where we learn to serve each other. And that's healthy, that's wholesome, and it's literally uplifting. No surprise, God made it that way. Now, let me show you the difference here for a moment. Satan offers enhancement, fornication, adultery, similar sins. This substitute, I'll call it soulless sex. You're not serving somebody. You're just abusing somebody. And to prove it, when you're through abusing them, you abandon them. That's why this practice of living in has become so prevalent. We can just abuse each other and use each other till we're tired of each other and then go find somebody else and do it again. Not learning to serve each other, not blending and uniting of two lives in unselfish service. So what I'm saying, it's empty of any real meaning. It's just a physical, brute, natural act. And it cannot produce true fulfillment. It just can't. God designed sexual intimacy so that husband and wife are serving each other as one flesh, as one person. This is in the context of that harmonious, unselfish life that we share. Here's something interesting about the study of the brain, neuroscience. People that study the brain say that the brain becomes trained by sexual arousal to find fulfillment in the mate. And here's something that helps me get a handle on that. I grew up in South Florida eating mangoes. My grandmother had a big mango tree. Went to the Philippines and, oh my, I tasted mangoes like I've never tasted before. Now, the more I ate those mangoes, the more I wanted to go back and eat another mango. My brain was being trained. And God designed the sexual experience like that so that it, just like I'm drawn to go eat those mangoes, you're drawn to your partner, to your companion more and more. The brain activity is involved. You see my point? It's not just like the animal, it's just a physical performance. It's got a lot deeper meaning. But neuroscientists have also studied pornography and learned that this retrains the brain to seek sexual arousal by looking at dehumanized images. So think of this, how Satan tricks us. Here, God has given me the gift of a real live person that I serve and she serves me, and sex is part of that life. But now I have retrained my brain to be fixated on nothing but images. This is dehumanizing. You're taking the real person out of the picture. So it would be like me focusing on pictures of mangoes. Oh, what beautiful pictures of mangoes. When I could have a mango. You see how Satan tricks us, deceives us, traps us? And it's all empty. It's a big lie. Pornography trains the brain to crave something that cannot satisfy. And more than that, it creates the vicious cycle of addiction. Satan enslaves people with cold, crude, cruel counterfeits for sensual love. Pornography is a cold, crude, cruel counterfeit. Voyeurism, people roaming around the neighborhood trying to look in the window and see a lady changing her clothes, is a cold, crude, cruel counterfeit. There's not going to be any fulfillment there. Even fornication is the same thing. There's no real fulfillment there. What happens if a thirsty person drinks salt water? He will burn with even more intense thirst. It will not satisfy. That's exactly how the devil plays this game. He offers us sex outside the context of marriage to quench our thirst. All it does is light a burning fire of intense sexual desire that cannot be fulfilled. It's a trap. Adultery, polygamy, rape, incest. It's a trap. There's no fulfillment here. Pedophilia, finding little children to have sex with them. People even, in some cases, practice necrophilia, break into funeral homes and try to have sex with a dead body. You think there's any kind of fulfillment in that? It shows how the intensity of the unfulfilled desire drives people deeper and deeper into sin. That's what it shows. Homosexuality doesn't bring the fulfillment. This so-called sex change doesn't bring the fulfillment. Do you see these are cold, crude, cruel counterfeits for the sensual love God gave in marriage? And here's the addiction. Think of how substance abuse works. The person gets a high from taking some pill. They can't stay on the high. They come down. And then there's a period of dissatisfaction, disappointment. They feel the guilt and the shame. And they begin to think, you know, I really shouldn't be doing that. So there's a moral resolve to not go back to that. But then later, there's the memory of that high feeling. And it's almost like a pain that needs to be medicated. And the way they know to medicate it is go get another pill. And then the cycle just keeps running the same circle. And this is what pornography does as well. Exactly. There's no fulfillment. The dog chases his tail and never catches it. He just runs harder and harder. So they're just things sex cannot do. Taking it outside of God's context, it cannot bring fulfillment, satisfaction. But as we think about this battle we're facing, and it is certainly rampant today, we also should know God equips us for this battle and for every battle. Pornography and sex have been made false gods throughout the history of the human family. We're not facing a new battle. God has armed and equipped us to face this battle. Satan, of course, is the master of deception. He turns everything upside down so that evil is good and good is evil. So I think back to Genesis 3, verse 5, the first time we see Satan so artfully in his role as a salesman. He can market sin as the greatest blessings. Genesis 3, 5. He said to Eve, God doth know in the day that you eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and you shall be as gods, knowing good and evil. You will become like a god yourself when you taste that fruit. You will be the one to determine good and evil. This is the mountaintop experience. Well, of course, we know it was a lie. But we learn from that passage how Satan is such a master at polishing the apple and making it shine. Oh my, sin is going to be such a great blessing. Pornography is an ancient ad for fornication. To understand pornography, think of it as an advertisement for fornication. That's what it really is. Even the word is derived from a Greek term, pornographos. Graphos, writing, graphic. Porn refers to prostitutes. So writing or depicting prostitutes to draw people to prostitutes. There's the connection to fornication. And pornography and fornication can be traced throughout history. Let me just make a little quick trip through some time in history. Go way back in the history of the nations. Babylon, Canaan, India, Greece, Rome, all of them. Religious pornography and prostitution were common practices. For instance, if you think about why would people actually worship sticks and stones? Think about that. Does it make any sense? It does if this god or goddess, like Diana and Aphrodite, are made as sex symbols. Great is Diana, remember Acts 19? This goddess was depicted covered in the female breasts, covered in them. So what is that? It's an advertisement. It's a come on. Not to learn about God, but to go to a prostitute. They went to the temples and had sex with the prostitutes in the temples. Now do you know why they might worship the God? So this is an advertisement for fornication, and Satan has even successfully projected that through religion. Jumping up to the 15th century, the printing press was invented. The first book printed was, anybody remember what the first book printed was? It was a Bible. But Satan quickly took advantage of the printing press, and you had the rapid spread then of pornography in printed form. Jump ahead to the 19th century when camera was invented. Is the camera evil? No. But Satan again kidnaps that avenue of spreading pornography. So you see how Satan keeps using every possible avenue. 1953, Hugh Hefner produced the Playboy magazine, which went worldwide, spreading this sin. 1957, the U.S. Supreme Court declared pornography is protected by free speech. So another explosion of pornography came to our nation. And then coming to the 20th and 21st centuries, the internet and electronic media have again made an explosion of pornography. So is it anything new? It's not new. It's just Satan finds new avenues to work through, but it's the same old trick. And this is sort of shocking if you think about it. Women bow to this idol of pornography as well as men do. The battle over proper clothing begins in the Garden of Eden. In Genesis 3:7, when Adam and Eve ate the fruit, knew they were naked, and made aprons that cover the waist and the private part and the top of the thighs, there is the first mini skirt. Started all the way back in the Garden of Eden. Genesis 3:21, God made coats or tunics that covered them from their shoulders to their knees. So this battle of pornography really does go way back, doesn't it? Even there were times that pagan philosophers protested this. There were Roman writers that protested when silk was imported from China and flimsy gauze-like material was made for women's dresses. And the pagan philosophers protested clothes made of glass. In other words, it had a see-through effect and rendered the women naked. That's the wording of those philosophers. So again, this is not new, folks. This is Satan's work back in time and history. Now, coming up to our time, you won't remember the name, but if you're old enough, you will remember the change. When the miniskirt was marketed and designed first in England by a woman named Mary Quaint in 1965, I did just a little bit of research about Mary Quaint. I dare say you don't know that she said, quote, good pornography is erotic. Now, here's a dress designer that thinks like that. I love vulgarity. Those are the exact words of the woman that made the miniskirt. She intentionally designed clothing to draw attention to the hips and the breast and the crotch. And it wasn't very long till parents in churches of Christ were letting their daughters wear that clothing into the assembly of Almighty God. And what a shameful defiance of God that is. And it still happens today, sometimes. Here's what one writer said back in 2003. 50 years ago, an American girl would have been ashamed to be seen in public with too little on. Now, she's embarrassed to be seen with too much on, even if she's in church. I don't know if there's anyone else here that can remember what I remember when the mini skirts began to be worn to church by teenage girls and sometimes their mothers. Did you know men had private conversations about the difficulty of serving the Lord's table? Because you don't want to accidentally tip that container and the bread or the juice spill out. So you look down carefully to hand it to her, and you're looking straight at her thighs when you look down. Because she's sitting there with her thighs uncovered. This is an abomination in the house of God, and it's an abomination outside the house of God. So women bow to this idol of sex. There are sex chat rooms, so-called sexting of pornographic messages and videos. We had a case in the church where I preach. A woman married with, I think it was 3 children. She starts this sexting to some guy over in Germany. Left her husband, left her children, left her Lord, and destroyed her marriage. And ruined her life. Do men do this? A lot of men do this. Do women do this? Women do this too sometimes. I want to think a few minutes about this. Is it harmless or harmful? Pornography? Harmless or harmful? A lot of people have declared it to be harmless. It's just entertainment, that's all it is. Even AARP, the magazine put out for seniors, received a letter from someone that said, "Help, my husband loves porn," asking advice what to do. But here's how they answered that. They produced an article claiming that pornography does not undermine relationships, immortal souls, or our republic. It's just innocent entertainment. This is Satan's lie again. But I want to think about this. Is it harmless or harmful? What is the effect on a marriage? Well, here's one effect. I violate my vow to love my mate only when I begin to focus my affections on these dehumanized images. I made a vow that I would not do such things. I dehumanize the women. First, this image is dehumanized, so I'm learning to think of women in that way. And it even dehumanizes my wife, because now I bounce from one sex toy to the other. Do you see, this dehumanizes my wife? It undermines the wife's sense of companionship and self-worth. When she finds out what I'm looking at, it's going to strike her that she cannot be equal to these polished images. And so this denigrates her in her own eyes. What's the effect on a marriage? It undermines her sense of security and trust. Marriage thrives on security and trust. She finds out I'm looking at pornography, she's going to lose that. She's going to be wondering, who is this man I married? Because I did not know he was this man. And what in the world does he want? She is there to meet my needs, and I'm walking away from that to look at these dehumanized images. What does this man want? And in case she were to stumble onto me looking at this on the cell phone, and she said, What are you doing? Who are you talking? Never mind, that's not any of your business. Oh, I just sent a clear signal. I'm hiding things from you. And so it doesn't take her long to connect those dots. She's married to a liar that's hiding things from her. My point is, what is the effect on the marriage? Harmless or harmful? I think you are intelligent enough to answer that without me answering it. How about the effect on the male? Let's go to that part. It reprograms his mind to lose interest in the life. And we have noted that even neuroscience has documented that. So I'm losing interest in the person that I pledged myself to. And then, not in every case, but in a number of cases, this perverted desire has led to rape and child molestation and incest, sex with our own children, and one more thing is murder. I'm confident some of you will remember the name Ted Bundy, who after many years was finally caught and convicted of raping and murdering at least 30 women that we know of. He was sent to the death chair in the state of Florida, but he did extensive interviews before he was put to death to explain how and why he killed all those women. He said, quote, he's speaking now of pornography, "You look for more potent, more explicit, more graphic kinds of material until reaching that jumping off point." So he got immersed in pornography. And the more he filled his mind with pornography, there came a point that he wants to act out. He wants to act on these images that are tormenting his mind. And so when he rapes, then the next thing is, to avoid being identified as a rapist, he kills the victim. And he managed to do this in at least 30 cases. It started with pornography. Harmless or harmful? How about the effect on children? Harmless or harmful? I'll let Ted Bundy make the first comment, quote, "Pornography can reach in and snatch a child out of any house today." Did you know Ted Bundy was raised in a home that went to church? He wasn't raised in chaos or by some street people. But he still was snared by pornography. I have a dear friend, a gospel preacher. He and his wife are wonderful people. And their son, teenage boy, got caught by this snare. It led him deeper. And he's now practicing homosexual and has nothing to do with his parents. They don't even know for sure where he is. It can reach in and snatch a kid out of any house. We need to take that seriously as parents. We must guide and guard our children in the use of electronic media. Be in control of your home and your family. Monitor your children's use of media of any kind. Require them to use it in open spaces so that you can see at any moment what they're viewing. And do not let them go in their room and close the door when they're using media of any kind. President Reagan used to say, in dealing with the Russians, trust but verify. You might be thinking, well, Brother Ron, we would want to trust our children. Well, I'll go for that, but trust but verify. Stay in control of what's happening. And think of the potential dangers to your children. Be very selective in their use and even the amount of time given to using electronic media. There are filtering devices you can put on these phones and laptops that prevent pornography. You should have family rules that are enforced with discipline. And you have every right to shut down the computer or take the phone. You pay the bills. You are the one putting food on the table. It is still your home. Do not feel apologetic about that. That's why God puts you at your post of duty. And here's something constructive to do to help protect our children. Build godly character by having daily Bible reading and prayer with your children. So that if they stumble onto this, which can accidentally happen, because the pornography industry are shrewd in ways that they can make this pop up when you're not looking for it. But if their hearts are filled with God's true love and God's truth, this will help them to turn away from it if they do accidentally come upon it. I want to remind you, Ephesians 6, verse 4, Colossians 3, 21, that fathers are not to provoke the children to anger, but to raise them in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. A father's perversion, use of pornography, can lead to molesting his own children. You can well imagine what the effect of that would be on children. This will provoke anger and resentment and rebellion and lifelong wounds and even infidelity. That's not something theoretical. That's not something I learned in a book. That's something I learned by living it. I knew exactly what closet door had a stack of pornography behind it. Growing up, we were victims of verbal abuse, physical abuse, and sexual abuse by our own father. I'm not telling this to ask for your sympathy. I'm telling this to help you understand the effect on children. My youngest sister, dead at age 21 with alcohol in her body, and she had numerous angry conflicts with my father. I have a sister who is one of the finest Christian ladies you could ever know, who has had at least 4 nervous breakdowns. The memories don't go away. What's the effect on children? I have a brother, precious and dear, near my age. We grew up doing everything together. And this guy is smart. I might have maybe one talent at least. My brother has 3 PhD degrees. That's the highest degree you can get. He's got 3 of them. My brother is a constitutional lawyer who argues before the Supreme Court, my brother, and wins cases at the Supreme Court level. He's a specialist in the Second Amendment. But my brother would not walk through that door and sit down in this room. Because he decided, if this is a Christian, I don't need it. So what do you think about it, folks? Is it harmless or harmful? I probably don't need to answer that for you, do I? Harmless or harmful? What about the effect on a wife and mother in her role in that way? She experiences deep revulsion when she finds out what her husband is doing, terrible pain and heartaches. and a sense of shame that I'm living with a person who does this. And she loses her sense of peace and trust and security. That's the effect on a mother and a wife. And look at this. You talk about Satan being shrewd. She will suffer verbal abuse, emotional abuse, and physical abuse when she begins to take steps to appeal to her husband to repent and stop practicing what he's doing. You know what will happen? Well, I see you've been spying on me with your puritanical morals. And by the way, I thought you were a Christian. And you don't know anything about forgiveness. So he makes a speech that turns her into the criminal, and he's the poor victim. That's how that works. That's how the devil plays that game. And she will literally feel knocked back on her feet. She doesn't expect to be hit in the face that way. She's simply trying to reach out to her husband, get him back on the right track, and now he's convicting her as criminal. What do you think the effect on a wife and mother would be in that situation? Harmless or harmful? She will struggle and cry and pray, trying to convince her husband to repent. And if he's caught in that cycle of addiction, she probably will not succeed. Think about this for the wife and the mother. She goes through her daily duties with the knowledge that she does not have full control of what goes on in her own house. Is my child being exposed to pornography because my husband is using it? Is my child possibly being molested? And maybe the child is afraid to talk to me about it. And how is she going to get those questions answered? I don't know. I know she's tormented by those questions. She is caught in a wrenching dilemma. How do I protect my child and myself in this situation? What possible options, what leverage do I have to change this situation? Now, we might say you should go to some family member and get advice. You should ask friends for their advice. You should go to the elders. You should find a counselor. You might need to report what's happening to the government. But, she's already been verbally attacked that she's the criminal and he's the poor victim. What do you think will happen if he goes and reports on what he's doing? She goes and reports on what he's doing. She'll be afraid to death what he might do next. So she's just caught in this dilemma, not knowing where to turn. So what about the effect on a wife and a mother trying to fulfill her role in life? Harmless or harmful? I need to touch on this and I'll close. No one is immune from these dangers. I have known of elders, deacons, and yes, gospel preachers caught in the web of pornography. One of the finest young preachers I have ever known. I mean, skillful. I might have one talent. That guy had 15 talents. I mean, I wish you could have known him. He was good in the pulpit, in the Bible class, on the radio, on the debate platform. He just, God blessed him with so many talents, sharp mind. Good presentation when he stood and taught. And one day I got a call that he had tried to commit suicide. I was astonished. I couldn't imagine such a thing. We had worked together. He'd been in my home. I went to him. What happened? How could this happen? He said, for 15 years, I have been drowning in pornography. I have successfully hidden it from my wife. And this was years ago, so when I give this number, you probably should double this number. He said, I am $60,000 in debt on credit cards because pornography took me to prostitutes. And it ain't cheap. And this destroyed that man from top to bottom, center to circumference. He lost his wife and children, his Lord. He lost it all. And so, who is immune from this danger? No one. Not me, not you. We're going to have to fight for our salvation. And one of the battlefronts is pornography. Thank you again for being so patient as we study. Let's take our break.